You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 74, Cultural Evolution.
Hey, Kim, what do you think makes humans so great?
Really good neuroscience papers?
It's actually not a bad answer.
Seriously, though, what do you mean?
Well, human beings have spread all over the world. We've radically changed the Earth for better and worse. And we have extensive technology and knowledge that other animals can't even dream of. Now, why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think the obvious answer is that as a species, we're smarter.
Yeah, so that's the most popular answer. And our intelligence is certainly a part of it. But I read a really great book. It's by Joe Henrich, and it's called The Secret of Our Success. It came out in 2015. And it makes a really good argument for an important nuance to this. And that is that what made our species so much more successful than others is our ability to pass on information about how to do things.
So what you're saying is learning?
Yeah, it's learning, but in a particular way. I mean, like, learning is actually really broad. All animals can learn, but it's observational learning.
But just to play devil's advocate here, aren't other animals also successful? Like, give an example, ants, right? Building their anthills, yeah. Working together.
Right. Ants are all over the place. So first, you know, there are about 12,000 species of ants. So
whoa.
It's true. Okay. It's true that ants in general are very successful as a group of species. In fact, if you were to weigh all the ants on Earth, it would weigh roughly the same as if you weighed all the humans on Earth. So there are a lot of ants. But ants are only able to spread into new habitats through genetic evolution and creating new species.
So for ants to move from, say, like a rainforest to a drier forest, they need to evolve into an entirely new species?
More or less, yeah, that's right. So as the ant populations migrate to different environments, they do it very slowly and they evolve as they go. And it takes many, many generations. And humans, on the other hand, are just one species, but we have people living in Antarctica and even in outer space.
Okay, I see. But isn't that, again, because we are so smart as a species?
Well, it turns out that just surviving on this planet for humans requires more know-how than a single human can figure out for themselves in a lifetime, let alone before they die of starvation.
Really?
Yeah. So let's take cooking, for example. Cooking is necessary for survival in most places, and we can't instinctively do it. This is really interesting. Mm. Chimps are fine without cooking, and they don't really need to be taught much at all. But we have to learn how to do it from people who already know how to do it. People would die off if they didn't have the know-how from their elders when they're born. So let's think about how interesting that is. So to survive, we absolutely need the culture to teach us, just to prepare the food. So Henrich makes this point really well with some historical examples of European explorers who got lost or separated in foreign lands. Sometimes they wander off or their boat gets destroyed or whatever. And what almost always happens is that they slowly run out of food and their clothing deteriorates and they all end up engaging in cannibalism and then they're all dead.
Mm. Wow. Yeah.
So, like, if they're not,
you know, smart after all.
So Henrich asks us, yeah, how much did their smarts help them, right? Yeah. These are like, you know, as smart as anybody else, you know, maybe smarter than average, right? World explorers with, an enormous culture of their own behind them, but not the culture of where they're from. And it turns out that they just can't figure it out in time. And the only time that these explorers survive is when they fall in with the indigenous people of the area, people who've been there for generations and know how to deal with the weather and prepare food and everything, and they show them how to live. And those are the only ones who ever make it.
Yeah, that sort of makes sense. So let's review. Human beings need to prepare and cook food to survive, but the ability to do this is not necessarily instinctual, and we can't figure out how to do it in a new environment unless, as you say, we're witnessing it from indigenous folks.
Right. Not in a month. You can't figure it out. No.
Is that a month? Is that how long it takes before we starve to death?
Yes, roughly. 8 to 21 days without food, you'll die. And so, you know, you can't figure it out in time.
Is cooking really that hard, though? I mean, I've seen my husband. He can open an egg and put in a pan. Is there more to it than fire and food?
Well, yeah. So when I say cooking, I'm referring to food preparation in general. But even cooking, you know, it's just not so simple. So you got to get the food somehow, right? That might require hunting, fishing, gathering. And in a new environment with, you know, animals and plants you're not used to, it's not at all obvious how to do this. Which plants are edible? You know, most plants are toxic to humans, right? How do you catch a seal in the Arctic, right? But then the preparation of the food, particularly from plants, often involves a lot of processing. Okay, we talk about processing today, like done by factories, like when you make Doritos and stuff. But actually, a lot of food that people eat all over the world is processed by hand, right? And the stuff we see in the grocery store requires simple cooking because for, you know, centuries of breeding plants and pre-processing the food before it gets to the grocery store, you know, we don't now have to go through a lot of trouble to make it edible. But in most natural environments, it's not nearly so easy.
Well, can you give us some examples?
Sure. So let's talk about hunting seals in the Arctic. So first, you have to find their breathing holes in the ice, okay? But you also have to know that the area around the hole has to have enough snow on it to hide the sound of your footsteps. Otherwise, the seals will hear it and they'll be spooked and the seal will never show up at the hole. Then you have to reopen the hole because it freezes over. And you got to smell it to see if it's still in active use.
Okay, wait. How do you know what it's supposed to smell like?
That seems exactly. Bizarre. Exactly. But the kids in the Arctic get taught by, you know, coming along with their parents and, you know, that's what it smells like. Oh, this one's dead. There's no seals have been here. This one's in active use. That's what it smells like. And you learn it. So even if the explorer or whatever knew that you had to smell for a seal, they wouldn't know what that smell was, right? So it's another thing you learn from your community, but we're not over. So then you cover the hole with snow.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
And then you leave a little hole with some down in it. Okay. And when the down moves and the seal is in there breathing, you have to blindly plunge a 5-foot harpoon in there. And the harpoon needs a detachable tip connected to a braid made of sinew. And you wrestle the seal to the surface where you kill him with a bone made from polar bear.
So obviously you're telling all this in great detail because you have previous experience killing a polar bear to hunt a seal, correct?
I have not had that opportunity. But this is how the Inuit do it. So like why would somebody who wasn't Inuit, right, think that they would need to get a polar bear bone and down to get a seal, right? And then you have to cook the seal. That's a whole other process. And just starting a fire in an environment like that with basically no wood is a big challenge, right? So there's so many ways for it to go wrong, so much preparation you have to do that nobody, including the 105 men on the Franklin expedition who died out there on the ice, they can't figure it out in time.
So what you're saying is we're successful because we can learn from others. And like you've done, you've also clearly read a book that talked about this, right?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, reading a book it's not observational learning. That's what we call testimonial learning. But that allows this like ratcheting, right? And the humans today are as competent as they are, and they appear to be really smart in part due to what is called cumulative cultural evolution. And we absolutely rely on that.
So cumulative as in it builds itself over time.
Yeah, right. So culture evolves over time, building on itself, getting more and more powerful.
Okay, so this is interesting because we're used to hearing about evolution in terms of the genetic evolution of living things.
Yes, yes. So let's talk about evolution, but abstract away from the evolution of life.
Okay.
Okay, so evolution is a natural process that will happen anytime these three things are present. So first, there has to be a population of individuals that have diversity. So they're not all the same. Okay, could be a population of jokes, could be a population of antelopes, could be a population of plants. And second, they can reproduce, but they don't all reproduce at the same rate. Okay, some die, some reproduce more. That's called differential reproduction. And then third, you have to have inheritance. So the offspring of the reproductive process has to have properties of the parents, right? And if anytime you have those three things, evolution will happen. And so life on Earth just happens to be the most spectacular and common example of evolution by natural selection, but it's not the only one. It's anytime these things show up, it's there.
So you said jokes as an example. So this is like a non-living evolution, right?
Right. So in jokes, you know, people tell jokes and there's diversity, right? So there's lots of different jokes out there and they mutate, right? People change the jokes over time. Jokes will go out of fashion because they're, you know, racist or something, or they apply to a politician that's no longer, nobody cares about anymore, like George Bush's wife or something, you know? And then, you know, people reproduce them by telling the jokes, and then they go into, they inhabit somebody else's mind and they get inheritance. So what happens is you get some particular group of people. So let's say you have a group of people that have a reputation for being dumb, right? So lots of cultures have this. I'm not going to name names because it's kind of offensive, but you know, we all know what they are. And they make jokes making fun of how stupid these people are. Okay. You go to another culture, you find the same joke, basically the same joke structure, but applied to their group that they like to make fun of and not the original. So the original joke was changed, repurposed, and spread in a new culture. It's kind of like a mutation that caught on and spread through a population. And that's cultural evolution. So this happens with recipes, with like proverbs, sayings, fashion, all kinds of stuff.
And relevant to this conversation, it's important for ways to survive, right?
Exactly. So things catch on for various reasons. But if, you know, some way of doing things, right, for a human increases your chance of survival and reproduction, then those people will pass on those methods to their children, right? We teach our children how to deal with the world. And that is its own kind of inheritance. You can think of it, right? That's where the heritability comes in. People who do things a certain way often teach their children to do it the same way. And this way, the idea will, over the generations, become more and more common in the population.
But might that be just because people can see it's very obviously a good idea?
Like, as opposed to what?
Well, do we really need to invoke evolution here? If people see a good idea and run with it, we have adequate psychological explanation for it.
Oh, right. I see what you're saying. Yeah, that happens too. So it's happening in parallel, right? So one study found that people tend to copy the behaviors of others when it's obviously a good idea, which is what you're talking about. They see, it's like, oh my God, that's so smart. I'm going to do it. But then the studies also show that people will do it when people with prestige are doing it or when everybody's doing it. They'll copy it even if they don't know what it's for.
Like how everyone in the 90s had Jennifer Aniston's hair. Well, women identifying people.
Well, I didn't have Jennifer Aniston's hair. Right. But
yeah,
yes.
Right.
We take that for granted. But, you know, it's interesting. What's going on here, right? People see Jennifer Aniston, or they did, as a famous, successful person. Okay. But do people really consciously believe that it's her haircut that gave her all that success? Probably not, but we are wired to copy successful people, even when we don't have any causal story about how that behavior might bring about success. We just have this urge to do what they do.
Interesting.
And since the clothing and the hair and how to walk and how to talk, they're really obvious, right? They're easily copied, right? The stuff that Jennifer Aniston does in her bathroom, right, isn't clear because nobody sees that, but they can see her hair, they can see how she talks, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And the point is that the copying person doesn't necessarily need to be able to figure it out if something is a good idea to copy it.
Right, right, right. And then the third one I mentioned is that people will copy something if lots of other people are doing it. Okay, so I remember when I was in high school in the 80s, all the boys wore white tube socks and we'd pull them all the way up. Like a gym
and
class.
Now that is like a dad sock vibe. It looks ridiculous.
Yeah, because the dads probably grew up in the 80s, right? So I remember being embarrassed if my socks didn't have the elastic tension to hold themselves up at least halfway up my calf.
Jeez.
Anyway, so it's not like I thought that would help me have more children or survive better and up in the environments of upstate New York, you know, but we evolved heuristics of copying. If lots of other people are doing it, it just might be adaptive. And so, oh, there's a great example of prestige bias from history. This is copying people with prestige. So on long sea voyages, there was no fresh fruit. So people would get scurvy, which is a vitamin C deficiency problem. And it's deadly. And it turns out that sauerkraut, like you could feed them lemons and limes, but they don't last very long. But sauerkraut keeps very well and it prevents scurvy. It's got a lot of vitamin C in it. But the problem was the sailors didn't like it. It wasn't part of their culture. They thought it was, you know, it's sour, whatever. And this one captain did something so smart. he only served it to officers. So they went on their voyage and the officers would eat sauerkraut and nobody else. And wouldn't you know it, not long into the voyage, the other sailors started demanding portions of sauerkraut. And they didn't get scurvy.
The officers were the influencers?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, the people probably figured, I mean, it's probably a gut feeling to want to imitate the superiors, but they might have also thought, well, if they're eating it and we're not, it must be because mm-hmm. it's some, you know, something good or special. And why don't we get this thing? And
people are so easily manipulated. And if you know psychology, you can hopefully get But are there examples of people doing things that are actually adaptive, but they don't know why?
Yeah. So, yeah, these are fascinating examples. So I'll give an example. So talk about food processing. And it's good to talk about it because, again, in our culture, our food comes kind of pre-processed. So we don't really have to worry about that. But let's talk about manioc. So manioc is a nutritious plant native to the Americas, but you can't just pull it out of the ground and eat it. So there's this people called the Tucanoans. They're an indigenous group in the Amazon. And what they do is they have to prepare the manioc for eating. Okay, it goes through a process of scraping, grating, washing, you extract the liquid, you separate it, you boil it, and you drink it, and then the fiber and the starch is left for a few days, then you bake it, and then you eat it. And the whole process takes days, and it's boring, and it's arduous, and the women spend about a quarter of their day preparing manioc. And most of the people don't know why they do it. It's just the way it was done. And what I mean is absolutely nobody knew why they did it. Until scientists came in there and figured it out.
Okay, so why did they do it?
Well, I'm going to get to that. I'm going to keep you in a little suspense.
Okay.
What the people think they're doing is getting rid of the bitter taste. Okay, so it starts off bitter, and what they do gets rid of the bitter taste. All right. So manioc, when it was discovered by Europeans, it got transported around the world. It started getting eaten in Western Africa. So the plant got moved to Western Africa, but the cultural know-how of making it, all that boring preparation, was not transferred. And so what happened was that the Africans who were eating manioc would eventually die of cyanide poisoning.
Cyanide?
Yeah, cyanide poisoning. So it takes years to have an effect. Okay, so if you eat this cyanide-rich manioc, it will kill you over the course of many years. You eat the cyanide for a long time before you see any effect at all. But in the long run, it's deadly, right? And cyanide poisoning is still a big problem today in Africa where they eat it because they still don't prepare it the way the Tucanoans do.
That is fascinating. And I only know about cyanide poisoning due to my fascination with Murdoch Mysteries, which has episodes on cyanide poisoning. And it is this slow burn.
I mean, we're lucky that cyanide isn't a big part of our lives. So
Yeah. So people would eventually die before they could figure out how to prepare manioc for safe eating, right? Like they just wouldn't know. You'd have potentially generations before they could figure that out.
Yeah. Well, the culture figures it out. The people actually didn't figure it out.
Right.
So, you know, imagine someone new arriving and mm-hmm. trying to figure out how to prepare manioc for safe eating. They would die, right?
So I still don't understand, like, how come the Tucanoans, is that who it was? Do they still not know why they do it? Again, they think they're just...
Well, they might have learned it now that it's sort of discovered, but traditionally, no, they didn't know why they mm-hmm. did it. And if you look across cultures, often the causal story for why these incredibly important procedures, you know, it's missing or incomplete. So when you ask people why they do what they do, like, why do you prepare manioc this way? It's often taken as a surprising question. Like they're shocked that you've even asked.
Mm. But do they give answers?
Well, sometimes. Sometimes they'll say, oh, it's the way we do it, or it's custom, or maybe there's a religious reason. You know, the gods want us to do it this way, or this is common. They come up with some theory on the fly. They just like the anthropologist is pretty clear that they're just making it up, as though they'd never thought of it before. And this is actually very common in ethnographic field work. You ask people why they're doing something, and they just make something up on the spot.
Fascinating. So we have these elaborate, time-consuming processes, and this is clearly arduous.
Yeah.
See, and it, like, obviously can we not remove some steps? Find a simpler way to remove the bitter taste? You know, like if that were me, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would try to do that too, right? So you might go to a place like this and see, you know, oh my God, you're doing so much work. Like, what's wrong with these people? Like, you know, you're trying to get the bitter taste out. Let's figure out let's add sugar, you know, whatever. Mm. And you'd probably think yourself pretty smart for figuring that out.
But then you'd die of cyanide poisoning years later, right?
Yeah, years later, right?
And you'd never be able to, like, infer causality, right? Because humans like to associate two events that are closely together in time or highly contiguous as having cause and effect. And you'd never be able to figure that out unless you had, like, advanced chemical forensic analyses.
Yeah, and even if you were sensitive to long-range, like, long-term causes— how many chances would you get to run trials to figure out that years of eating, you know, figuring out like which parts were the magic sauce, right? So it's a cool example of not using your intelligence, you know, like not using your intelligence to attempt to optimize the procedure is actually doing you good.
It's wild.
You're better off like accepting it as it is. Now, when I read this, I mean, this hit me like a ton of bricks. I had to put the book down and like think, right? Because I'm the kind of person who's always looking for more efficient ways to do things, right? I would be the one of those people who would look at the traditional way of doing something and try to improve on it.
And you'd die.
And I'd die, yes. Not right away, but I'd die. And it was a very sobering realization, right? The cultural practices help the people in a way that the people themselves do not even understand. Now I think this is cool too. And I'm a left-wing person generally. But reading about this helped me get a glimmer of what might be going on in conservative people's minds.
Well, how's that?
Well, I think a lot of conservatives have an appreciation for tradition and a feeling that we kind of mess with it at our own risk. So they, you know, conservatives often are, they want to put on the brakes for changing the culture quickly or whatever, you know, and I think they are probably thinking like, well, it got us this far. Maybe we should be cautious when monkeying around with it. And examples like this show me that sometimes this attitude actually is for the best.
Interesting. Can you give us another example?
Sure. So this one's cool. So there's a group of caribou hunting people called the Naskapi. Now, what they do to figure out where to hunt is to heat a caribou shoulder blade over hot coals. So they have an old caribou shoulder blade. They put it over the hot coals until it cracks. And the bone will crack in a particular pattern. And then they read into these cracks in a way that tells them where to hunt, kind of like a divination process. Now, of course, as far as we know, this is random, right? The cracks in the shoulder blade are not, I mean, they're appearing based on like the details of the fine structure of the bone, how hot it is, and probably a lot of chaotic factors. But I mean, very unlikely because of information about where the caribou are going to be in the future, going back in time and causing the bone to crack in a certain way in the past, right? I mean, that's...
Okay.
Right. Here's the thing.
Okay.
This randomizer actually helps them. Okay. So it basically functions as a random, like a random hunting, pointing people to a random hunting spot. Now, it's human nature to want to return to a place where you got a lot of food before. So if you hunt somewhere and there's a lot of caribou, next time you're like, let's go there. But the caribou also are smart and they don't go back to the place where there's danger. Right? Where they recently saw predators, that is humans, they aren't likely to go back there. So actually going to a random location as determined by the cracking bone or anything else, dice or whatever, keeps the caribou guessing and increases the hunting yield.
But the Naskapi don't take it as random.
No, they believe it's true divination, right? Mm. It's worked into their religious beliefs. But the interesting thing to me is that their ignorance about the true nature of the cracking is actually adaptive. That is, if they were to believe the cracking was random, they might ignore it. And then they might hunt instead where they felt would be most productive. And that might be exactly the places the caribous are avoiding. And they get less food. So I think it's so crazy. Like sometimes the ignorance of why it works is actually important.
Yeah. And cultures discover ways of preparing food that are appropriate for that environment in the same way, right?
So this is the key insight of like how the crowd can be wiser than the individual or how a culture can sort of quote unquote know things that the people in it don't and the culture can learn things that the people in it don't, right? So this is also why we see spicy foods in hot climates. So in places that are like, you know, some cultures have spicy foods and others don't. But it, there's a really strong correlation with hot climate, right? So when it's a hot place, food rots more quickly and there's a greater danger of bacterial infection coming from the food. And so hot peppers they reduce the amount of bacteria. It's an antimicrobial. Cilantro is also antimicrobial, but some of its power is eliminated by cooking.
Oh, so that's why we would cook a pepper but put cilantro on raw after cooking is done?
Yes. It's actually more healthy to do it that way. And the cultures figured that out. Like now, things like garlic and onions and peppers, their antimicrobial properties can withstand cooking. And so, you know, we have recipes that say you cook the onions and the garlic and the peppers, you know, but at the end you put on the cilantro.
And wasabi helps reduce the danger of eating raw fish, right? It's another antimicrobial. So the secret to our success is obviously cultural learning. And yet now we eat wasabi because it's delicious and spicy and yummy.
Well, that's the thing. We come to believe it's delicious because we've gotten used to it and we kind of insist on it. But, you know, studies do show that, you know, liking hot food is something that has to be learned. It's learning to associate a certain kind of a pain with a positive experience. So it does have to be learned. We naturally don't like hot foods.
Right.
Anyway, so what's the secret? So according to Henrik, okay, specifically cumulative cultural evolution is the secret to our success. So scientists are smart, yes, but lots of their discoveries are only possible because of the hard intellectual work done by their forebears, right? So a biologist using a confocal microscope, you know, doesn't need to understand, let alone invent the microscope to make discoveries with it. They only need to know how to use it, how to interpret its output. And so this is a ratcheting effect. So you've heard scientists say, like, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, right? And this is the cumulative cultural evolution. And now what's cool is we can see some interesting psychological studies that support this view. So there are studies where you show human kids how to do things, and they try to copy you pretty accurately, even if you're doing something irrelevant.
Such as?
I'll tell a story from my nephews. There's a cute video of one of my nephews was singing a song and dancing around, and his little brother was trying to keep up and imitate him. Anyway, the older brother fell and landed on his bottom in the middle of the song and said, whoa, and then got back up and continued. And the little, like, 2.5-year-old dropped to his bottom and said, whoa.
Because he thought that was part of the dance.
Anyway, so let's just take an example from, like, if you, let's say you're showing somebody how to take a lid off a jar. If you tap the table next to the jar first, right, that's irrelevant to getting the jar open. But kids will often, they'll copy that. They'll tap the table before opening the jar. And they don't understand the importance of tapping the table. And it's actually not important, right? But they'll copy it anyway. And what's interesting is that chimps in the same experiment drop irrelevant actions.
What? Aren't chimps smarter than us? Or aren't they pretty similar?
Well, they behave differently here. So this is why that Henrik thinks that, dropping an irrelevant action is what we might actually consider a smart thing for a person to do, a human to do.
Right.
But here, human kids don't do it. They imitate even stuff that they have no idea what relevance it has, but chimps will not. Right? So sort of showing that the chimps are not mentally equipped for cumulative cultural evolution the same way we are. Anyway, this was originally done on Scottish children. Then it was replicated with African kids in the Kalahari. It's called over-imitation. And it's taken as evidence that human psychology is specifically tailored to cultural transmission. So you can learn how to do things correctly without needing to understand how it works. And so then cultural evolution can hone a culture for flourishing, and the people in it can be oblivious to how and why their methods work so well. The story has been that non-human animals survive mostly by instinct, right? They can learn a bit in their lifetimes. And, you know, humans can figure things out, right? They can noodle it out there. But although we do figure things out, we also look to others to see how to do things. Right. So when we're encountering a new situation, people often look to how others are behaving to figure out what to do. We do a whole lot with observational learning.
Case in point, Jennifer Aniston's hair.
Right, right. So it's our ability to copy without knowing why is our special ability, even when it results in copying irrelevant things like haircuts.
And I would imagine that when people copy others, they don't necessarily copy everybody equally, right?
Right, yes. Yeah. So we talked about prestige and success, but actually age is also a factor.
Like, are older people respected and copied more than younger?
Yes, that's right.
But yet we have a problem with respecting the elderly, at least in North American culture.
Yeah, so in this culture we do, but that's actually pretty unusual. In most cultures, at least historically, the elderly are greatly respected, admired, and their advice taken to be very useful, right? And this is probably, it's like the wise old man archetype, right? Or the, you know, wise old woman or something. But this
sage,
is probably because,
the oracle.
Yeah, this is probably because for most of human history, think about this, the world that your grandparents grew up in looked a lot like the world you grew up in. Right. So most of history, right, the world didn't change very fast. So the lessons that these people learned by the time they were old and how, you know, what they learned about how to deal with things in the world were still very useful and relevant, right? Because they figured it out and they grew up in the same world as you. But now the rate of change today's world, the rate of change is faster, but actually it's probably slowing a bit. But yeah, I mean, generally, you know, we're in a world where change is happening a lot faster than it did like hundreds of years ago. It was really big and now it's starting to slow down again a little bit, but that's probably why we don't turn to old people so much.
Yeah, I would imagine that the pace of things is changing exponentially. Like what our previous generations learned 20 years ago is now out of date, and you know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah. But what's interesting is that there are several scholars have argued that there was 100 years between about 1870 and 1970 where we had the most rapid change in human history. And after that, it's sort of slowed down a little bit. So things got introduced like cars and phones and refrigeration and airplanes and computers. So, you know, you can imagine being born into a world with nothing but like outhouses and horse-drawn buggies, but you die in a world with computers and people flying all over the world in jets. So, you know, in contrast, I was born in a world with all those things. And now, you know, there's some things that are new, but kind of like I got a smartphone that can do a lot of those things, right? I can watch TV, talk on the phone, and do computation on my smartphone, but it's still basically, you know, TV, talking on the phone, and computation. So it's thought to be a little bit more incremental, but not as radical a change as in the past.
Right. So as a kid, I learned how to put a VHS tape in a VCR. And my kids aren't doing that, but they're still working with technology versus my parents would not have done that at the same age. Is that's what you're saying, right? Like, it's like there's...
Yeah. And ultimately, they're trying to watch a video. Like, videos weren't... Right. I mean, there was no way to watch a video before the invention of film, right?
Fair.
And that was a huge change. But now it's sort of like, okay, you got to do, you know, you watch a video in a different way, but you're still basically, we're still watching movies, you know?
Got you. So back to the elderly teaching us things. Isn't there a theory that this is related to why we have longevity?
Yes. Yes. So it turns out there are very few species where the elderly non-reproductive family members hang around for so long, right? So, you know, old humans and, you know, old animals don't reproduce. So why are they hanging around taking resources from their family members? And it's in these species where this happens, where the teachings of the elderly are particularly important. And these species are humans, elephants, and killer whales.
That's it.
It's cool.
Yeah. So, but yet now our world is changing, right?
Right. So the faster the world changes, right, the less, you know, the more quickly this or that way of dealing with the world becomes outdated.
And this is why we have my parents asking my kids for help with their smartphones and setting up their TVs. And by contrast, when a young person wants to figure out how to edit a TikTok video, they don't text grandma.
Right. So, and your example is interesting because your parents aren't asking you, they're asking your children. Like, you know,
correct.
How fast is the technology is changing so fast that not only do your grandparents not, or your parents not know how to do it, but they assume that you don't know how to do it as well as as a kid.
They're probably right.
Yeah, they probably are, but that's because, like, you know, we actually, you know, we evolved in a world where you know, you learn your cultural environment, and by the time you die, it probably hasn't changed very much. So the plasticity of learning mainly happens early on, even though now our technological world isn't like that. So we turn to young people for help, right? Anyway, so people prefer another, you know, you asked about people preferential copying, right? People also prefer to model their behavior on people of their own race or gender. So for many things, the way women do things in a culture is more useful to girls, and what men do is more useful for boys. And studies do show that people prefer to learn from members of their own gender, and this supports the idea that there should be diversity among teachers and faculty members and that kind of stuff.
Hear, hear. So what this is all from that amazing book you just, well, you read a little while ago. What's the name of the book again for our listeners?
The Secret of Our Success by Joe Henrich. I can't recommend it enough. It's like every other page is like some great revelation.
Mm, awesome. Thanks for the recommendation.
You bet. And remember, if your grandma starts editing TikTok videos better than you, it's probably time to ask her for tips.
Absolutely. Who knows? Grandma might go viral before any one of us do.
Oh, exactly. Oh, talk about ultimate plot twist. Yes. Anyway, thanks for tuning in, everyone. And until next time, keep learning and stay curious.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. If you want to connect with Minding the Brain on social media, you can find us on Instagram at Minding the Brain. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.